again, listeners. Thanks for tuning in to the LMA podcast. Today, we have another installment of P3Cast for you, brought to you by LMA's Client Value Shared Interest Group. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to the LMA podcast P3Cast series. My name is Madison Toff, and I am the Strategic Pricing Manager at Perkins Coie in New York. And for today's discussion, I'm sitting down with Rebecca Benavides as the Director of Legal Business at Microsoft. And today we're going to be discussing mindfulness in the legal industry, which will be the focus of the P3 Women's Initiative Network session at this year's P3 conference in Chicago. The P3 Women's Initiative Network, or WIN, is meant to provide a platform to help discuss best practices and encourage information sharing within the legal business profession in an effort to better promote the roles of women within our evolving community, both within and outside of P3. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Thank you, Madison. I'm happy to be here.
So let's dive right in. When people kind of hear the word mindfulness, they might think of images ranging from meditation to a garden to Buddha. Can you maybe share your thoughts on kind of what mindfulness means to you?
Sure. So it's actually a little bit of a funny story. My mindfulness journey started about 3 to 4 years ago when my husband, as a birthday present, gave me a gift of a series of meditation classes at the local Buddhist temple. It was clear that he was obviously telling me something. I went. I was a little bit hesitant because, like you pointed out, I mean, I had this idea of this like sort of garden and this very zen place, and I was in a point in my career where my work environment was just not very zen. And so I remember showing up for these meetings, rushing from the office, and everybody else had clearly had the opportunity to go home and change and get comfortable. And I was sort of, looking at my high heels alongside all of the sort of sandals and flip-flops. And, I just really went in with an open mind. And while there was a huge focus on what you just noted, the sort of taking the time to do a deep meditation practice that involved, sitting in the quiet, dark room and really clearing the mind. What I really loved about that series of classes is that they also focused on more accessible forms of meditation and mindfulness. And what it sort of, instilled in me was this notion of taking the pause and taking time within your daily life to practice little spurts of mindfulness, whether that means, sort of taking a breath between activities to just refocus your mind. One of the great ones that I've adopted is the washing of the hands. So whenever I switch from one meeting to another, you're going to take a bio break. And in that, the sort of the taking the time to really wash the hands and focus on the water and the movement and the sensory sort of, the sensory observations around that really does, again, allow you to free your mind from what you just did and then move in fresh into what you're about to go into. So I've really been very happy to have taken those classes. Do I practice deep meditation on a regular basis? Probably not. But I do find moments in my day to do those little acts of mindfulness that I think are very helpful for just clearing the mind, because we're all very, very challenged to find that in our very busy daily lives.
Yes, absolutely. And it's always interesting that everyone's introduction into things like this can always be so different. So mine was a subway sign that said, "Are you seeking or in the pursuit of happiness?" And I ended up going to this practical philosophy class. And then I got really into the book, The Secret, which is about, gratitude and the law of attraction. And I kind of segued that into, should I then explore meditation? And I remember, kind of similar to you, thinking, I don't even have time to go to a meditation class, but maybe that's exactly why I should be going. It's just kind of, So it's almost like trying to customize that to your schedule and what you think will actually work for you. So the classes I were going to were focused on what's practical, not, go 5 times a day and it has to be 20 minutes exactly, but where can you personally find your pockets of time?
This might resonate with the audience quite well, is at the end of the day, when I try to go to sleep, I'm usually, you know, there was a time when I am just going through my mind, running through all the things that need to get done, basically like the mental checklist of what's pending and what needs to be sort of moved off of my list. But what I've started to do, and it has really been helpful because you need to sleep, your brain needs to rest, is really using that time to count your breath. And that's how I fall asleep, is I breathe and I count my breath, and that counting clears your mind, slows you down, and enables you to fall asleep in a way where your mind is not racing through your mental checklist. So, you know, I agree. It's finding that accessible way to practice mindfulness throughout your day, because that's the only way it's really going to stick for anybody.
Absolutely. And it's what your idea of it is, not what someone else's.
Exactly.
So when we kind of think about, you know, the audience likely coming from mainly the legal profession, what do you see as common issues in the legal profession around health and wellness, mindfulness, all kind of all of the things we've talked about so far?
Yeah, so my background is I actually was a practicing lawyer for about 8 to 9 years. I was primarily in a litigation practice before I moved into what I would call the business side of the law, where I was supporting lawyers in a law firm and now in-house. And, you know, there are a ton of articles out there, and there's a lot of initiatives around improving mental health in the legal profession. You know, it's clear that there are issues and concerns around alcohol and drug abuse. There are issues around mental health. You know, and I think I hate to always generalize that there is something about lawyers that makes them different. I think that there is certainly something about the profession and its history that makes it more susceptible to some of these issues. You know, I can speak anecdotally. There is sort of this interesting thing about the notion that all lawyers are these type A personalities, when in reality, I've met a lot of lawyers. I was one. Not all of us are type A's. And in many instances, we're probably covering to be that image of what people think a lawyer should be.
Sure.
And it's a high stress job. There are expectations put on you from your clients. And that is, you know, a client that could be a large corporation down to the client who's pro bono divorce case you're handling. Mm-hmm. You really are trusted with a lot of responsibility to help a client through a difficult time or a challenge. And obviously for the audience who support lawyers, that sort of stress trickles down to, you know, the people that are supporting them. I think there's also a lot around the notion that or the principle that a lawyer has to zealously defend their client, that I think puts a lot of pressure that doesn't leave much room for mistakes or fumbles. And that can make the practice of law, even when you're in a large law firm, very lonely. Mm-hmm. If you are struggling with some of these issues, you don't feel comfortable telling others or sharing the challenges that you may be having on a personal level, because it may be seen as a sign of weakness or a sign of a liability for the firm. And until we start normalizing those discussions and actually showing to people that there is a place to share those vulnerabilities without the danger of being ostracized or looked at differently, without putting your professional career in danger, I think that is the way that we're going to see some true changes. I will say that I think a lot of firms are really focused on this and trying to do better. I was on a panel probably 2 months ago with managing partners of a number of law firms in the Bay Area. And when we went over the topics, it was interesting and refreshing to me that they really spent a lot of time talking about mental health and well-being for their lawyers and their staff more than they wanted to talk about salaries or talent acquisition or real estate. I mean, it really had become a very top of mind issue for them. And that is refreshing and something that I think is a move in the right direction.
That's great. So on top of, you know, firms on the client side, do you see other legal organizations kind of opening up the opportunity for these issues to be more openly talked about?
You know what's interesting? I think the fact that we're having this conversation as part of your podcast and the Women's Initiative is a really big sign that other organizations that support legal are taking this on. You know, there was probably a time, a day when we would have been doing this podcast and we would be having a discussion about my work, what I do from a professional basis. And the fact that I was invited to come and talk about this important topic, I think is a sign and really a sign again that other organizations that support legal are really taking this sort of head on.
Great. Do you have examples of kind of how you've seen Microsoft start to instill, whether it be a formal initiative or anything they've implemented?
I am very fortunate, and I think a lot of folks at Microsoft are very fortunate in that the company does take a very proactive view towards mental health and mindfulness. So there is a clinic on campus. You can go there for any sort of, you know, illnesses, but also a lot of there are a lot of appointments you can make for, you know, massages, chiropractors. I think there's an acupuncturist there, which again, the connection between sort of body and mind health is very strong. And so the fact that that's offered on campus to take that time out to focus on your proactive and preventative health, I think is important because that's obviously sort of flows into sort of your mental health. As a manager at Microsoft, I have a wealth of tools available to me from our HR and benefits department to take part in sort of counseling and other opportunities, either for myself or for employees that report to me. I get a daily digest of what's available at Microsoft, some of which is free to employees around mental health and well-being. And so we are strongly encouraged to take advantage of these benefits, because I think Microsoft, you know, rightfully has a culture in which we do believe that taking care of yourself and encouraging our employees, to take that time for themselves makes them better and more creative and more impactful to the overall organization. So there are a ton of initiatives. Again, I'm very, very lucky, and I'm sure that there are a lot of companies and firms that are trying to do the same for their employees.
Yes, agreed. So aside from kind of what Microsoft is doing, is there anything that you personally try to implement within managing your own team to try to create a culture of mindfulness, whether it be, you know, timing of emails or expectations of hours people are working, things like that?
I've done a lot. I've put a lot of these into practice, I would say, over the past sort of year and a half. Some of them are a bit new, but we're sort of trying them as pilots to see how they go. One of the things I know that I have done is because I think we'll talk about the idea of work-life balance. But what I really try to do is really encourage kind of dark times when we are not paying attention to our phones, we are not watching email. So at least with my team, if it is not a true emergency between the hours of like 7, 8 p.m. up until, you know, 7, 8 in the morning, you're probably not going to see me online. If you see me online, you're probably not going to get an answer to that email unless it is a true emergency. And I likewise try to do the same. I do not send emails in the evening. I try not to send emails on the weekend. I have a great little app that lets me delay the sending of emails. So I may draft them if I feel like I need to do it, but I do not send them because I don't want to create a sense within my team that there's some urgency that would disrupt their time away from the office.
Absolutely.
We do focus a lot on remote working. So long as the work is being done, if you need a day because you need to handle items at home or you just need to be home because it just feels like a home day, we encourage people to take that time. You know, I think a lot of it, we focus a lot on the way we work and how we encourage people to share their thoughts and their insights in kind of an open forum, and to be free to do that without sort of any fear that their voice won't be heard or will be put aside. So we encourage that in our team meetings. The other thing we try to do is I think it's an opportunity to focus on kind of empathy. So I encourage both myself and my employees to really think about when they're interacting with somebody to take the pause and before we react to whatever the request is or whatever that person's kind of demeanor or tone is, to take the pause to really try to listen and understand where that person might be coming from so that we can be more effective at answering them and meeting them where they are, as opposed to having something kind of escalate in a weird way. So that is a little bit less measurable, but the idea of really sort of listening more and talking less, I think is a very powerful tool that people can use in their teams.
Great. Yeah, and a few things we do on the Perkins side is for every weekly team meeting that we have, we actually start the meeting with an icebreaker. So I've kind of found that the more social engagement that's not work related that I get to have with the team, that just kind of smooths over everything as far as our working dynamic. You know, if I know what Johnny just did for Memorial Day weekend, I'm less inclined to create tension because he didn't get me something on time, and kind of creating opportunities for whether it be small talk or connecting socially with team members.
Yeah, I think that's hugely important. We spend a lot of time on morale events where the broader team, that is the legal operations and business team, we plan them after our team meetings. We have monthly team meetings, and you know, every other one, we try to end that team meeting with a social event that just lets us be people outside of work and connect with each other on a more personal level. Because you're right, I think it's important to understand, you know, the work is great and the work will get done. But I think you care about the people that are doing the work. And in doing so, you're only going to make them more effective.
Absolutely. So you've teased the idea of work-life balance, and I always kind of joke when I hear this that it's like, is this a formula that I'm supposed to follow? Is this a certain feeling I'm supposed to have? Am I ever actually going to be balanced? Kind of talking more about work-life balance and kind of what that means to you and how you feel like you reach to achieve it.
I actually have moved away from this work-life balance notion. I think it's just a juggle. It really is a true juggle. I mean, we were joking just before we got on this call that, you know, every morning, I'm a mom, and every morning getting my children out of the house and on to school is just not a mindful or an exercise in mindfulness. it's more like a drill. And, you know, today was no exception. And then I got into the office and I had a little bit of a fire because I had missed somebody's email, which is not uncommon. And had to sort of scramble and get to it and put it out. But it was funny because I was thinking like, oh my God, I'm a little bit stressed right now. And now I get to talk about mindfulness. So, you know, it's just a juggle. It really is. I mean, I think as we were saying before, you kind of have to find the ways that work for you to get there, to get to that balance. And I was also thinking about this, you know, and you sort of hinted at this when you said this work-life balance, is there a formula that I should be following? Mm-hmm. And I actually think that's a little bit of the problem, is there are a lot of these articles about work-life balance and what you can do, and it's focused on the individual, what you as the individual should be doing. When in fact, I think we almost need to flip it and say, what can the organizations that employ these individuals be doing? Because you're only going to achieve this balance if you feel like you're in a supportive environment at work that allows for it, that understands that Madison needs to have this time, you know, in the mornings where she's focused on X, Y, and Z. And that may mean that she's not going to be responding to certain things until she's in the office and on. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that there is a big responsibility on the part of the organization to build a culture in which it is understood that people get their time away, that people need to have that time and not be sort of rushed to anything. I will say that culturally here at Microsoft and in the legal department, I have been very impressed with the fact that people do walk the walk when it comes to taking their vacation. When they are out and that message is on, people respect that. You know, I rarely get emails when I am truly like on a vacation and not, you know, I don't even say anymore. I may respond to emails. The answer is nobody expects you to. And I think that that's great because I think that that culture allows me to do that juggling act better. And if that culture weren't there, I don't know that I would focus on my juggling act. I'd be trying to do everything at once. And so, you know, it's a little bit of what the individual can do, but it's also, I think, there's an impetus on the organizations to find that for and make it available for their employees and note that it's okay to do that. But again, it's a constant juggle. I mean, we were joking the last time we talked about this that, you know, my day can have so many aspects to it that, you know, the other day, my daughter, we're going on this Girl Scout camping trip and she got all amped up because apparently I lost glitter packets. I don't even know what these glitter packets are for. I have no idea. I'm very fortunate that my husband is the work from home parent and he handles a lot of this. And, but clearly I was responsible for glitter packets. I had no idea what this was. Somehow by walking her through her various steps of the day, found the glitter packets, issue resolved. And 15 minutes later, I had to get on a phone call to talk about, you know, this complex legal fee arrangement in Europe. And, you know, it went from glitter packets to legal fees. And, you know, somehow you've got to find a way to make that all work. And so I think it's a constant juggle. And, but, you know, I think we'll all get better at it. But you do have to be, you have to be mindful about how you employ it in your day. Because you do have to care for your individual well-being, glitter packets, fees and all.
Yes. Well, and it's kind of like, it's almost faking it till you make it, right? Because you decide, okay, I'm going to do work now. I'm going to do personal now. It's then combating the guilt that you feel if you're zoned in on one activity and not the other. And that's the, you know, if you're fighting human nature in that regard all the time.
That's true. And it's funny because I had a conversation the other day, just kind of a hallway water cooler talk with one of the lawyers on our team, and we were sort of lamenting how busy it is at this time of the year. And there was, you know, this sort of discussion about how it's in certain roles it can be challenging. And I would suspect that the audience can relate to this, where you are, on the one hand, part of your role is just dealing with all the little bit, the fires that have to be put out, the emergencies that have to be catered to, but then at the same time, trying to be strategic, especially if you're building something, if you're building a team or you're building a program, or you're helping sort of think about the firm or the organization's strategic outlook. Like, the mind just doesn't seem to be geared to both doing kind of the fires and that sort of very frenetic energy, and then thinking strategically. Like, you need focus time to be able to think strategically. And it was funny because I was like, well, hey, when you figure that out, let me know. He was like, I try. He was like, somebody told me to read a book and I read this book. I'm sorry that I don't know the name of it. He said, and it really just said that the human brain isn't built for that. He was like, so you know what, Rebecca? He was like, you just got to take the walk. You just got to take the walk. And I was like, okay, well, that's actually helpful. I mean, it really is. You just got to take a break between dealing with the fires and take that pause to reorient yourself to what you were trying to do when you were thinking strategically and doing that focus time work.
Well, and it's kind of like, you know, I feel like most days I go about my day and the day happened to me, like I have no control over it. But it's like you can try to, you know, find opportunities where you actually feel like you're controlling it, instead of it's just fire after fire and you're just, the day is happening to you.
And I think, and we talk about this, when you're doing that, I think, you know, it's kind of okay to say that the day happened to you. it's to just take, take that break. Like, that happens so often that, you know, it's something I also have been doing more of, is I think giving yourself more credit for those days, and being kind to yourself in those moments. Instead of, like, on a day like that, you know, I have to fight the urge to be like, oh my God, that day happened to me, and now I start thinking about all the things that I didn't get done. Like, what is still on that mental checklist? Mm-hmm. And instead of, what I've tried to start thinking about, especially on those days, is what did I get done today? Like, it's actually kind of amazing that I was able to put out those fires and was able to help those individuals, was able to get X across the finish line. And it taking stock of the accomplishments that you do and the impact that you have on a given day, I think is beneficial for everybody. I think it's primarily beneficial for women, because I think in so many ways, as mothers, sisters, daughters, partners, friends, we take on a lot of the burden of helping others and supporting others. And that we always feel that guilt creeps in. And instead, we need to be patting ourselves on the back for all of the stuff that we do get done on any given day, rather than thinking of what we did not accomplish.
Yes, agreed. And I feel like a little bit of it is, I've personally tried to know more about myself. Like, I will overextend myself by, you know, RSVPing to 2 happy hours, a birthday party and a brunch, yeah, knowing that there's no way I'm going to actually want to do that come Saturday. So also trying to protect myself from myself by saying, okay, based on history, am I likely to actually go to this, and not trying to put myself in a position where I have to cancel last second or something, but kind of knowing yourself to avoid putting yourself in situations where you're going to feel guilty or imbalanced. So we've kind of covered flavors of this, but wanted to also discuss a little bit more directly this idea of burnout. You shared a great article with me earlier this week from NPR talking about burnout as now being considered more of a legitimate ailment that employees can have. So kind of thinking about this, you know, do you any comments on this idea, or do you think of this as, you know, a factor of the individual? Maybe they're just an overachiever or a workhorse and they're more susceptible to this, or is it partly that, partly the work environment created, kind of explaining your thoughts on burnout?
Yeah, sure. No, I do think that it is a big function of the environment. We are, and I mean, I say this and I'm going to date myself quite a bit. I was fortunate to come into the practice when it still wasn't an on the call, every day, 24 hours a day, and weekends practice. You know, we had just really started using Blackberries. And so you'd get emails, but people were still kind of struggling with, you know, working in that way. But now I think that there is just really no opportunity to be off. I do think that there are more pressures for, especially for law firms, and partners and lawyers to get more business. And in doing so, it creates this dynamic in which, you know, everything must be responded to, everything must be dealt with, and it must happen now. Mm-hmm. And again, by virtue of that, it trickles down to the people that support them, the professional staff that really try to help them get more business. You know, I think burnout is a real systemic issue. It's not always the person that is the overachiever. In fact, it is likely that person that's trying to balance or trying to juggle work and family, and they feel like they are failing at both. Mm-hmm. And they feel like either way they go, none of it is getting done, none of it is moving forward. There is a lack of fulfillment sometimes in the roles that they are getting. I do think that it's a bit of an epidemic. I think that I'm glad that that the WHO has really sort of started to focus on this as an actual diagnosable, ailment, because there are signs of it, and I have seen it you know, in both my practice, and I've seen it when I've been on the other side in the business support function at firms. And it's not insignificant. And so I think that, again, I go back to, I do think that it is a bit of the responsibility of the individual to sort of find a way to take care of themselves. But there is a big onus on the employers to think about the long-term mental and physical sort of well-being of their employees. You are, in fact, hurting your organization more by not focusing on that and not giving your folks the resources that they need to deal with these issues. It happens. It's not ever, we're not going to be in this wonderful place where it never happens. Mm-hmm. But I do think that organizations and employers can do more to give people the support and space that they need to combat it, and to also recognize when it's happening, and not always focus it on a performance issue. Because I think that's also a bit of it too, is, you know, being able to recognize the signs of burnout, I think, are important, so that you're not adding, you know, fuel to the fire and treating it as a performance issue when in fact somebody is truly struggling.
Absolutely. And I think especially for listeners who are maybe just beginning their career or just getting into legal, it's, no one ever teaches you the skills to stand up for yourself and say, hey, I physically can't take anymore. What can I do? I've had to teach myself that through my career, on understanding what I can physically take on and accomplish in a given week, and had to learn to advocate for myself when I felt like I was being given more than I could handle. And part of it is also, you know, a unintended side effect is you might give a false impression of resources needed for a team. So if you have five people that are burned out and doing the work of 10 people, no one's ever going to give more resources because they might be thinking that they're totally fine with the five people. So I think that's part of the unintended consequences, is, you know, not catching it or not having people that feel comfortable advocating for themselves, is the status quo will continue because you don't think you need additional resources.
That's very true. I mean, I think that, you know, again, that's an extremely valuable point, is, you know, I think we all want to get the work done and we want to excel at what we do. But often you're covering for some real issues, such as not having enough resources. And resources could mean people or could mean technology or something else that you really need. But the fact that you are all kind of covering and manually dealing with some really sort of pressing requests, you know, you're right. Like, leadership doesn't always dig into the details because they've got a bunch of other things on their plate. And there's always a tendency to be like, well, you're doing fine. Everything's getting answered. You're doing great, in fact. And so, you know, you've got to be able to advocate, as you said, to say like, yes, we're doing great, but can I tell you, you know, and you can prove it with data, how much my people have been working. What are the things that we're not doing while we're focusing on this? And again, it goes back to, we put out the fires, but what we're not doing is growing strategically. And, sure. And you know, we've got to be able to do both. And when we're under-resourced, we can't get to that strategic place, which I think is where people really want to be able to see their employees utilized, because it's sort of highest best value for the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. So another effort we are working on as part of the P3 Women's Initiative Network is a mentorship program. So women in roles similar to ours, whether on the client or firm side, would be paired up with a mentor or mentee to meet on a regular basis. Do you think topics like this, like what we've discussed today so far, could be potential options for discussion as part of a mentorship program for WIN?
Oh, absolutely. I have benefited immensely from what I would call accidental mentors. Mm-hmm. People that I wasn't in this formal mentorship relationship with them, but I either worked with them in some capacity or interacted with them in some other way, and really sort of started to look at the things that I liked about what they did and some of the things that I didn't like about what they did, in order to form my own kind of style. But when I think about what P3 is putting together, which I think is amazing and great and much needed, I would tell people that, you know, my career path has been winding and varied. Like, if you had asked me when I got out of law school, you know, X number of years ago, I won't say, if you had told me this is where I'd be at this point, I don't even think I would have understood what you were talking about. It was just so foreign to me. Like, the fact even that, you know, roles in law firms like pricing and legal project management and some of these other roles that didn't even exist 5-6 years ago, to know that that was an avenue for me way back when, you know, I could have sat down with a mentor and we could have charted my way all the way up to partner. Which I think there's a tendency to do that, is to sit down and have what I would call purely professional kind of role tracked discussions. Sure. You know, I admire you as a mentor. How did you get to your position now? And what is the specific path you followed? And so I think that there is space for that conversation. But then I think that there's space for conversations like this, where you get to flex a bit more on what I would call your emotional, your EQ, basically your ability to deal with a lot of the things that are going to come at you that there really is no playbook for. The interpersonal relationships that you're going to have to build and foster. I mean, so many of us, you know, in the roles that we're in are often change agents. So you're leading a new initiative, you've got a new program, you're trying to get people to do things a little bit differently than what they've done in the past. And so there's an element of change management in all of that. And learning how to flex on your EQ and sort of your empathetic muscle is really important for where you may go in your career. And so I think that there's room to have these conversations around how, you know, not only do you deal with the, you know, I want to go from pricing manager to the director of strategic pricing. Sure. Mm-hmm. There's probably a roadmap for that. But really thinking about how are the different ways that you've had to navigate interacting with the people that you support and the people that you manage? Because it's those skills that are really going to drive you in a way that you may not even know where you're going to end up in a couple of years. So I think, you know, having those discussions within a mentorship program are immensely important for creating a more well-rounded sort of individual and to get the most out of these mentorship relationships. I will say that one of the things that we have started doing here is really looking at our folks' professional development, not only from the roles that they have, but also the skills that they need for the roles of the future. And so I think that that's also an important element to have within this mentorship discussion is, you know, not only what is the current state of these roles and where I want to be, but also what's potentially there in the future that nobody's even really talking about right now.
Sure, absolutely. And I remember, you know, when I first started in legal, I kind of laughed thinking about these moments where I would be in a room with mostly men that were 20 years my senior who had multi-million dollar books of business. And I was there to advise them on what to do with their practice.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember constantly thinking like, am I actually qualified to be doing this? And now I don't even think about that. But some of the, you know, routine meetings we're in or the advice we give, you know, as women in our profession, we're usually in similar situations and kind of getting used to that and not having, you know, having the confidence to feel comfortable doing that on a regular basis is definitely an underrated skill for sure.
You're right. And I think that is the ability to just maneuver in that. You know your stuff. You know what you're talking about. We're all smart, educated, professional women and individuals. And so you know your stuff, but how do you navigate a room in which you're going to have, you know, some skeptics? You're going to have some people that aren't going to immediately say, that's the smartest thing I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. Because it happens. They may be completely wrong, but it's going to happen. And so how do you, as the individual, sort of maneuver and work through those situations? And I think that is a very valuable discussion to be having as part of a mentor program. I will also say that this another thing that we started doing And I'm still gating my comfort level in doing this is as a leadership team, we, as part of our monthly meetings, we do talk about our greatest misses. So instead of talking about the things that we've done, we want to show some vulnerability to the folks that report to us by talking about, when did I not do a great job? When did I feel like I actually failed? And I'm still not great about talking about it. but, you know, others are, and I'm getting there. But I think it's important to share with people when you made mistakes and what you learned from it. Because, again, it takes a little bit of that stress off from, you know, the individual who wants to succeed and wants to do everything perfect and feels like there's no room for mistakes. This leads to that burnout issue. It leads to these sort of other issues within the legal profession. It's okay. You're going to make mistakes. Things are going to happen and things are going to go wrong and you're going to fail sometimes at epic levels. But guess what? Everybody that has done that is still, for the most part, around. Still here. They're still talking. I think what we tried to emphasize, folks, it didn't stop my trajectory. But, you know, I've learned from it and here's what I've learned. So even talking about kind of the misses within these mentoring relationships, I think could be valuable for folks. Because one, the mentor who's sort of having a place to release this kind of thing, you know, this fail or this mistake that they made, I think, and in kind of that private setting, I think is really cathartic for that person. And then the mentee is sort of taking in kind of the lessons learned from it. So I think it can be a beneficial conversation.
Great. Do you have any tips or tricks that you use to help maintain your balance or kind of prevent this stress and burnout cycle?
So, you know, I have learned I'll start off with saying that there are any number of books and articles and apps that people have recommended to me over the years. You know, I will start reading them and just think like, I need to find what works for me. And so that's sort of what I tell people is, you know, for you, it was reading that book and it worked for you. And so, you know, I think take all of it with all of these resources available, take them, try them. If it doesn't work, don't let it distract you or don't let it impede your ability to get to something that is accessible. I will say that over the past year, I have taken more of a focus on my physical health because I do think that it is very much, at least for me, a big factor in my overall mental health. So I have started going to, you know, exercise classes twice a week. On the weekends, I've started sort of hiking and biking and doing things that get me out and in nature and also just really focusing on getting stronger. I do think that it lets me have that pause in my busy life where the only thing I'm really thinking about is the fact that I have to, you know, climb up that hill or I have to lift that weight. I've started doing kind of hot yoga, and I will tell you that there is nothing more mind freeing than trying to hold a pose while you are sweating profusely in a
Sounds
hot
about
room.
Right.
Yeah. and so I do think that if I were to give advice to someone, I do think that focusing on a physical activity that is, that you like, that you enjoy doing, is going to go a long way in giving you that kind of mental release and mindfulness that you need. And also it's just great for you. You know, if your body is doing what it's supposed to do and it feels good, then, you know, you sort of feel charged to take on a lot of the things that are going to come at you in your daily life because it's not just work. There are going to be personal issues. There are going to be family issues that come up as you get older. And, you know, you've got to almost steel yourself for what may come at you on any given day. So, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't have a laundry list of books and apps and everything else. I'd encourage people to sort of explore what other people recommend to them. But I will always say to sort of focus on your physical health and then also really find something that works for you, that is accessible for you. And it's just yours. It's not for anybody else to comment on. It is your thing. And I think that that goes a long way in making it kind of stick over the longer term.
Yes, absolutely. And some of the things I do kind of in the, you know, mistake recovery or things just kind of happening you can't control is I will literally say the words, this is not the end of the world. This is not the end of the world. Because some of the things, it's so easy to assume everything is. And then I also will say, you know, I'm not going to remember this in a week. So while mindfulness is maybe focused on trying to be present, sometimes I will actually force myself to jump out of the present to say, this will not matter in a month. This will not matter tomorrow. This is not the end of the world, and kind of tricking your brain into removing yourself from the situation.
Yeah, that's very good. I will also say that laughter is a big, it is a big healer of many things. And so I would also offer to have a really good sense of humor and also an ability to laugh at yourself. So it's a little bit of what you just said, this idea that like you may be sitting there in that moment stressing. There's a little bit of self-realization and a little bit of realizing, kind of having a sense of humor about yourself to say, Madison, not a big deal. You know, it will not be a big deal next week. And so, you know, I try to bring laughter into any number of things that happen and find the humor in it, because usually there's always a little bit of something. I think it helps diffuse sort of tense situations if used properly, if used correctly. I can't oversell the importance of humor. It's good to laugh. It's good to enjoy other people's company. And so, you know, find ways to bring it into your life and just, yeah, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Smiling and laughing is a good thing.
Well, amazing. I think we covered quite a lot of ground here and I enjoyed having a chance to talk with you. So thank you so much, Rebecca, for your time and participation, and hopefully all the listeners, we have a chance to see you all at P3.
We hope you enjoyed this latest P3 cast. To learn more about the P3 conference, visit legalmarketing.org/P3. If you like the podcast and want to help others find us, please take time to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Thank you and have a great day.